in the Labour Party youth camp to the Hitler Youth, Glenn Beck. My guest today, Vijay Prashad, is a George and Martha Kellner Chair in South Asian History and Professor of International Studies at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. He is the author of 11 books, most recently The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World, published in 2007. Two of them, Karma of Brown Folk, published in 2000, and Everybody Was Gung Fu Fighting, 2002, were chosen by the Village Voices Books of the Year. The Darker Nations was chosen as the best nonfiction book by the Asian American Writers Workshop in 2008, and it won the Muzaffar Ahmed Book Award in 2009. His articles frequently appear in South Asian periodicals, his monthly column Letter from America in Frontline magazine, his book reviews in the Kathmandu-based Himal, for which he's a contributing editor, in North American periodicals Z Magazine, Color Lines Magazine, and the Indian American, and you could find his articles frequently on Counterpunch and ZNet. He's also contributing editor on the online magazine Naked Punch and a member of the editorial board of the scholarly journals Amar Asia Journal and Left History. Welcome, Vijay Prashad, who takes on the world.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Glad to have you here. When I first contacted you about coming on today's program, it was to speak about a recent article of yours, Drone Land, on the Counterpunch website, which dealt with the expansion of America's unmanned wars in South Asia and the Horn of Africa, and the lack of response by the anti-war movement, and to discuss when we and other nations of the world can expect to see drones being used for domestic surveillance and police work. And then we had the bombing of government offices in central Oslo and the massacre of some 68 children, many of them immigrants, by a man self-identified as an enemy of Islam, a supporter of Israel, an opponent of multiculturalism, or what he called multicultural Marxism. And you have an excellent article for Counterpunch as well on that, Palestine's Norwegians. So let's begin there. First, I'd like your take on how the mainstream media in the U.S. and Europe reported on the Norway events, and what does it tell you us about the Western mindset on this issue?
Well, you know, I'm glad that we're beginning there, because this is linked, of course, to the warfare that we've been, you know, party to over the last two decades. What I think has happened is, since the late 1980s, there has been a growing and deepening sense that Muslims are different from everybody else, and their difference is in the fact that they are dangerous. And there has become a knee-jerk sense that this sort of different danger that the Muslim poses cannot be reasoned. In other words, there is no way to have a rational dialogue with somebody who's so different from you and who is so dangerous compared to you. And so whether it's to do with the Palestinians in Palestine or the Iraqis or the Al-Qaeda, Taliban, or your next-door neighbor, Muslims have to be dealt with force. That is the underlying idea that I think has grown, has developed over the past two decades. Of course, it's an absurd idea. Muslims are human beings. Muslims have an ideology, but at the same time, Muslims, you know, eat, go to the grocery store. They have to live their lives. Certainly, there are some things that are different, and indeed, difference is what one should celebrate, not fear-mongering. And I think this idea that Muslims are different and dangerous is part of a broad ideology of fear-mongering that has grown, I think, over the last two decades. So, yes, I believe that this Islamophobia, what we call Islamophobia, permeates the mainstream media. You know, an attack takes place first in Oslo and then in an island where, you know, young people in the Workers League were conducting their summer camp. And immediately, not just the television news, which has often less sense than anybody else, but the print media leapt into the fray. We had Jennifer Rubin, quite a respected, I suppose, by some people, blogger at the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times. Every one of them suggested immediately that the perpetrator in Oslo must be Al-Qaeda or must be a Muslim. This is a deja vu situation, because they did exactly that in 1995 after the Oklahoma City bombing. And ironically, the man who conducted this action in Norway was himself an Islamophobe, and the media that was reporting his acts was utterly Islamophobic. And that is where we have come now.
Well, it seems as expected, whereas somebody who may be Muslim, a Palestinian, commits an act, it's immediately labeled a terrorist act. As a matter of fact, in Israel, Palestinians are referred to interchangeably as terrorists. Someone like Timothy McVeigh or like Breivik are called madmen, as if they're acting in some kind of isolation, have no connection with reality. Maybe you could talk about his connections with reality.
Well, you know, you're precisely correct that when the Muslim acts, they are terrorists or they are irrational. When Breivik acts or when Timothy McVeigh acts, they are either lone men, or when the United States decides to go to war in Afghanistan or Iraq, it is doing so under compulsion. You know, we don't see the acts of, say, drone warfare as the work of madmen or terrorists. We see that as us having to act under compulsion, either to protect civilians or to make sure that innocent people are not harmed. You know, we can kill you, that is, an innocent person, as long as you are not harmed, but you, if you try the same thing, you are a terrorist. Coming to Breivik, I mean, you know, he had a very long schooling in the world of the new European right. And that is not quite the same as the European right of the 1940s. You know, the fascism of, say, of Goering and of Hitler and of Goebbels and of Mussolini was of a very different order. Times have changed. Contemporary European fascism, what I consider Eurofascism, is of a different sort. It develops from the 1970s and 80s, when the so-called immigrant problem emerges full-fledged as a political crisis. You know, so that from Britain all the way out to Germany, up into Scandinavia and down to Italy, there is a new ideology that begins to gain respectability, and that is to question whether immigrants should be allowed to come in large numbers, and this is largely immigrants who come from Asia and Africa, whether they should be allowed to come in large numbers, and whether they should be able to allowed to maintain their customs and traditions. Now, by the way, this is a very strange conversation, because many of the people who come into Europe had come following a pathway made by Europeans. You know, the French colonized Algeria, and then the Algerians come to France. You know, when the French were in Algeria, they were not complaining, saying we should not build cathedrals in Algiers or in Oran because we don't want to hurt the culture of the Algerians. On the other side, when the Algerians come to France, the French say you cannot wear a headscarf because that hurts our sense of cultural homogeneity. You know, the link between colonialism and the kind of immigrants that come in the 70s and 80s is absolutely direct. The only place it's not direct is when asylum seekers come. So to Scandinavia, which was, I think, had the most wide open heart towards asylum seekers, when people from Sri Lanka and other parts of the world sought asylum out of their civil wars, Scandinavia welcomed them, you know, which is why Scandinavia has a large number of Sri Lankan Tamils, now Norwegian, for instance, or Swedish or Danish. So, you know, the emergence of this new kind of Eurofascism was essentially in opposition to a cultural difference inside their societies, and an illusion was created that somehow Europe is a pure place with countries that are homogeneous. That is far a real incredible fantasy, because Europe itself has a turbulent history of mixing and matching, and, you know, people drawing from each other's heritages. And I just mean, you know, it's not like they were all Celtic tribes or Germanic tribes and they remained separate. You know, they were all intermingling. The Romans were everywhere bashing heads. And then later, Mongols will enter. You know, it's a very turbulent place. Eurasia was a continent to itself. So this idea that comes in the 70s, that somehow there is purity in Europe, was absurd. And it was itself a fascistic idea. And, you know, Breivik will refer to writers who emerge in this period. He He takes inspiration from the emergence of very far-right thinking in even places like India. So he refers a lot to the emergence of the Hindu right, which is itself fascistic, and refers to the Italian fascists. So there is a sort of economy of references that Breivik has, even though the manifesto goes on, and it's, you know, rather breathless in its incoherence. Still, this anti-immigrant thing is the core of the Euro-fascist ideology. And they draw from all kinds of ideas. Breivik himself has an affinity for the Knights Templar and that kind of stuff, and says he is not an anti-Semite. Well, he is not an anti-Semite because Euro-fascism of today's variety is not all anti-Semitic. Many Euro-fascists will look to places like Israel and say that they are a main ally in the war against Islam, because Islam is what is our principal enemy.
Well, I know the global war on terror. There was a meeting in late 60s, early 70s in Israel, that's Jerusalem Institute, in which they talked about literally waging a global war on Islam in the name of a war on terrorism, and we've seen that develop. It's interesting the inspiration that Breivik got from American websites. Before I called you on the phone, I pointed out that the day before the attack, there was an article in Front Page magazine put out by David Horowitz, who I used to know, in another life of his, in which they openly justify what Breivik was going to do the next day. He said, this guy wrote, Norway is effectively under the occupation of anti-Semitic leftists and radical Muslims and appears willing to help enable the destruction of the Jewish state of Israel. And then the very next day, we have the attack. Now, of course, it seems that Mr. Breivik was a fan of a man named Robert Spencer, who has a blog called Jihad Watch, which, but not insignificantly, is sponsored by the same Horowitz's Front Page and Horowitz's Foundation. Maybe you could comment on the American Islamophobia and how it influences that in Europe and in Mr. Breivik.
Well, there is David Horowitz, certainly. That's one strand of it, sort of intellectualized Islamophobia. Daniel Pipes is another, from Pennsylvania, from Philadelphia, the son of a Soviet scholar. So there are these sort of, how would I put it, amateur or they are think tank intellectuals. I prefer to think of David Horowitz as a think tank intellectual. But people like them who accumulate their resentments against, others into lists of the worst academics or most dangerous academics, things like that. It's very appealing kind of rhetoric, an anti-intellectual rhetoric that they have put out there. There are people like that. But then there are others. There are people like Pam Gelner. The fight over the mosque so-called mosque at Ground Zero. It was not at Ground Zero. It was in the Wall Street District. But that's how they framed it. The fight over the mosque in Lower Manhattan, the fight over mosques across the country, the mad preacher in Florida who wanted to burn the Quran, and that thing, that whole strand in the United States of deep felt anti-Muslim feeling is something that is identical to, or it's kin to, this idea that is there in Europe, where there is a fear of so-called minarets coming up in the cityscape of European cities, or Sarkozy, one after the other, going after burqas, then going after street preachers. A very minute number of women wear burqa of the kind that the French want to ban, and yet they made a huge issue of that. There are hardly any street preachers in Paris or in, Lyon, but yet they want to go after that. These issues are important because they widen the seam of hatred, rather than address an actual issue. Nobody is going after, in parochial schools, nuns wearing crosses in a classroom. Because in a sense, if you follow the argument, if you're not allowed to have religious symbols in public spaces and that's why the burqa should not be allowed, well, then nuns should not be allowed to walk around in public either. You know, or priests should not be allowed to walk around in public in their garb. They should get into civilian clothes. In fact, you know, maybe we should suggest that American troops should not be allowed in military costume in public. They should get into civilian clothes because it's, the military state violation, you know, that kind of argument. But it's an absurd. It was an entirely specific argument. It was against Islam. It was not about secularism or what the French call laïcité. Certainly not about that. So there is a broad, fraternal sense of being attacked by this cloud of Islam that unites these intellectuals, Horowitz, Pipes, with, these so-called community activists like Pamela Gellner, with politicians like Sarkozy and Peter King. You know, there is a sort of fraternal cloud that covers them over. Now, in the immediate wake of the Norway attacks, most of them have said, we don't like this tactic. We don't like this strategy. We grieve for Norway. But some of them have had the honesty to say, but we agree with Breivik. And, that is at least a confirmation of this cloud that is shrouding the Atlantic Ocean.
My guest is Vijay Prashad. We're talking about Oslo. We're also talking about drones and the use of what you call drone land. And as I mentioned before I called you, the two issues are intrinsically connected. Here we are waging a war on countries, all of which are Muslim countries, which is Islam is a dominant religion. And what is the message that the people in Pakistan and Afghanistan and Yemen and Somalia, Iraq, have actually received? This is kind of, and it also seems that it has lulled the anti-war movement into a deep sleep. And I'm not sure how much it has to do with drones not being F-16s or whether the anti-Islamic sentiment, Islamophobia, has also penetrated much of the left, whether it admits it or not.
Well, one of the problems I would say is that, our sloganeering has got in the way of our analysis. You know, this idea of support the troops and bring them home, I think, is fogged up some people to the idea that if Americans are not dying, then there is no war happening outside. You know, and this is a view that some in the Obama administration have even taken, including Harold Koh, who went before a congressional committee and essentially said that the conflict in Libya is not a conflict because no Americans are dying. You know, and that puts it plainly. If bodies are not returning that are dead, then the war is not as bad. Now, you know, one has to say that because of the very good chest armor, people are not dying, but increasing numbers of people are being wounded, maimed, losing limbs, etc. But since we don't have a visual sense of this, I think that there's a sort of denial that there is a war on. I'm not sure if there's any residual Islamophobia in the anti-war camp, but certainly I think there is a hesitancy. We don't know how to move. In the Bush years, things were much clearer. Bush had the temperament of somebody who, anybody with a right mind would feel repulsed by. Bush had the, rhetorical abilities to turn the, to curdle milk, so it was able to provide a unity between those who were committed to an anti-war platform and those liberals who either just didn't like Bush or were embarrassed by Bush's kind of wars, what Obama called rash wars, dumb wars, in his speech from 2002. So during the Bush years, there was an appreciable, a valuable anti-war camp had formed. During the Obama period, that camp has fallen off. Largely, it is the problem of demobilization every time a Democrat comes to office. Because the Democrat says, I will do everything you want me to do. You go home, unlike Bush, they are not vulgar enough to say go shopping. But they'll say, we'll take care of it. We'll close down Guantanamo. We'll disentangle from Iraq. We'll disentangle from Afghanistan. Leave it to me. Of course, that has not happened. Quite the contrary. Guantanamo remains. There is a surge in Afghanistan. Iraq is not going to be untangled. And Mr. Obama has, in fact, increased American hostilities by utilizing drones from the border of Libya way out there to Afghanistan. In fact, one of the, I think, least mentioned things is that at least Mr. Bush, had people arrested and sent to Guantanamo. Mr. Obama seems to have preferred the technique of extrajudicial assassination, which the United Nations, you know, has said some rather uncharitable things against. So in that sense, because he is a Democrat and because he has promised to do various things, the movement has not been as mobile and active as it was during the Bush years, despite the fact that Mr. Obama's record is, as bad, if not in some ways worse than Mr. Bush. So I think that that puts us in a real peculiar place, and I'm very glad, therefore, that late last year there has been an attempt to refound the anti-war movement, and it has some legs, I think, because I was there at the April 9th march in New York, and very happy to see the new social constituencies that make up the anti-war movement.
Of course, one of the problems that we've had with the anti-war movement, and it helps to explain why both the Iraq and Afghanistan wars have gone on as long as they have, is the absence of a military draft, which Nixon wisely eliminated and took the air out of the anti-war movement back in during the end of the Vietnam War, as I recall, and that without a base of young people whose lives might be in danger, it's very difficult to get a significant number of Americans involved in opposing a war which doesn't affect them as personally as the Vietnam War did so many people within the anti-war movement. And then, of course, if you had a draft, you would have the college campuses, which are almost quiet at the moment, erupting, and so they've been able to wage these wars with no one paying attention. And how do we get around that issue?
Well, one of the things that I think is important is to make the link between the total economic collapse of the United States and the wars that it's prosecuting. Wars are deeply expensive processes to fund, and the Conference of Mayors recognized that when it adopted our language, the anti-war language, to say, bring the war dollars home. Well, I recognize that this entire economy is built on war and war industries, so it's very hard to just immediately detoxify it, by bringing the war dollars home, because the war dollars, to some extent, are home in the war industries, which are in every single congressional district almost. So it's still good that they have started to make that link. In other words, what I'm saying is it may be true that there is no draft for people to go and fight, but every day our taxes are being siphoned into the war. In other words, we are paying for something, and we are paying for it, if not with our lives, then with our livelihoods. And I think that is very important, and that connection needs to be made. Somehow, I think people believe that wars happen outside economics, and that, the cost of war is in lives. But the cost of war is not in lives alone. It is, in fact, in well-being, and the well-being of the people who are at the other end of the drones and the well-being of the drones. Each time a young, military person sitting in a base in Las Vegas or in New Jersey, it decides to fire from a drone, that hellfire missile, when it leaves the drone, the entire process of it landing and killing people on the ground has cost $100,000, each missile. The missile itself doesn't cost $100,000, but the firing of it costs $100,000, keeping the drone up in the air, the gas, the one officer sitting there, all that stuff. That's $100,000 per drone, per missile fired from a drone. That is a lot of money, and I don't think we've come to appreciate that our so-called sacrifice may not be with our bodies, but it has certainly been with our communities and our ability to survive, in the United States.
And my guest again is Vijay Prashad. I'm going to open the phones here in a few moments. One thing has occurred to me, and I've mentioned a number of times on my program in the past, the drone is a kind of word that puts you to sleep, where if we knew that American fighters were attacking these countries with F-16s, this would be an open war. And yet, with drones, Americans don't really realize how many wars the United States is in and how much they're costing. And there doesn't seem to be, unfortunately, the labor unions have not mobilized what's left of their membership to bring this to the attention of the American people. How do you see the unions or functioning in this atmosphere?
Well, you know, part of the problem is the gap between unions and the Democratic Party is too narrow.
Is there one at all?
Occasionally you hear some grumbling, but yeah, there is no gap. During the Bush years, for instance, when both President Obama and the unions both complained that Mr. Bush was using supplemental requests to Congress to finance the wars. In other words, that Mr. Bush was disguising the total war cost through mysterious forms of presidential accounting. You know, we were not given the full cost of the war. By the way, the National Priorities Project in Northampton calculated that since 9/11, the entire security apparatus, including all the wars, has cost us $7.6
trillion. Trillion dollars.
$7.6 trillion. The war in Iraq and Afghanistan by themselves, just war spending, has been $1.25 trillion. But, you know, NPP decides that you have to include things like veterans. If I go and fight in Iraq and I'm wounded, you have to include the entire lifetime of, you know, medical support that I will require. Otherwise, you're not actually being able to calculate the cost of the war. Anyway, they have calculated $7.6 trillion. Since Mr. Obama has been in office, the unions have not said anything about supplemental spending and presidential forms of accounting. And that, I think, is a problem. I mean, is it because they are tethered to the Democratic Party? I mean, I recognize that the Republican Party is an organization of lunatics, so I have no truck with them either. But there is no independence that the union are able to have with policies that mimic the policies of Mr. Bush. And I think that's very troubling.
Well, I guess the Democrats are counting on Obama, the Democrats are counting on the fact that come 2012, whoever's put up by the Republicans is going to be so horrible that Democrats will hold their nose and go back and reelect President Obama. And this is the problem that we seem to be dealing with every 4 years, but the selection gets worse.
That's right. I mean, you know, look, if the American people can take Michelle Bachmann seriously, and if they can actually think that Mitt Romney is, as he likes to consider himself, a working stiff, you know, we have a real problem with mass delusion.
One of the things I wanted to mention, and I mentioned to you in my email and earlier on the program, is we have the domestic scene has benefited or not benefited so much from a lot of military hardware that we're not even aware of. But I begin to foresee the use of drones domestically for surveillance and police operations in the United States and elsewhere because they're so relatively cheap to make and safer to use in certain hostile situations. And they even have some drones that are about a yard long and can be thrown in the air handheld and take photographs of whatever they're supposed to take photographs with good resolution. Do you see this Big Brother thing coming here and elsewhere?
Well, you know, I don't know what they're going to develop for us, but if history is any guide, it seems that, nothing seems to stop the states from utilizing whatever technological developments are available for either maintaining so-called control over the population or order amongst us. You know, I every day thank the military for developing the internet. It comes to us via the DARPANET. But at the same time, you know, as we got that, we got the highly sophisticated surveillance techniques that they use via the internet. So that's the dialectics of history. They have developed drones. I cannot think of any good civilian use of drones, you know, except perhaps that if there is, say, a fire somewhere, you can send in a drone to do a surveillance and investigation. Maybe drones can go and drop some kind of, flammable material to put fires out. So there may be some good civilian uses of drones, but if history is any guide, I'm sure that the drone will be used for something quite terrible, you know, including surveillance.
Well, probably that would be the first way they'll use them in order to introduce them to the public and then expand their services, so to speak. I know it's interesting. I had an article the other day. The U.S. Air Force is seeking the right stuff for a Predator pilot. They've developed psychological profile for a pilot of a plane, but now they're trying to find a perfect profile for someone sitting in an office in Las Vegas who sends Hellfire missiles to kill other people. They're looking for a profile of that. And, of course, that's one of the reasons they've encouraged the video game players, because that's a perfect training for killing people at a distance without emotion. It's now 8 minutes before the hour and end of the hour. And if any of you have any questions for my guest, Vijay Prashad, the number here, of course, 895-2448 or 1-800-499-7117. One of the things I'm going to get back to our initial subject, you wrote in Counterpunch, Palestine's Norwegians, that support for the Palestinians in Norway has been unusual in contrast to other European countries, even Scandinavia. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, Norway is quite a remarkable country. It has a very progressive heritage underneath this. It's had one since the 1880s, 1890s. When the Norwegian Labour Party was formed, Norway stayed out of World War One on grounds that it was indeed not a war for people's benefit, you know, which is what the left wing in the Second International had tried to argue, and they lost that position. So Norway has a long-standing progressive left-wing tradition. In recent years, that is over the last 10 years, the Norwegian Labour Party student wing, particularly, has been very, very active in the campaign to raise awareness about the occupation of the Palestinians. Now, one reason Norway has such an important role to play is it was in Oslo in 1993 that the so-called Oslo Accords were signed between the Palestinians and the Israeli government. So, you know, these young people have pushed their government over the last decade on questions of, tightening the trade relations, you know, restricting arms sales, restricting the ability for Norwegian funds. You know, Norway is an oil-producing country, quite a wealthy country, so not allowing Norwegian funds to be invested in Israeli firms, particularly those firms that make profit on the occupation. So this AUF, this student group, which is the youth league of the Workers' Party, of the Norwegian Labour Party, has had a very important role in Norwegian society, all told. And recently, the AUF has been agitating on two accounts. One, to deepen the boycott, divest, sanctions movement against Israel within Norwegian society. And the Norwegian foreign minister had just come 2 days before to the AUF camp and had heard out the students with their, program for the BDS campaign, the Boycott, Divest, Sanctions campaign in Israel. The second thing that the AUF had been pushing for, which is what the Norwegian government had done, was for Norway to take the political lead in saying that they were going to accept the Palestinian position in the United Nations for statehood. You know, the statehood campaign is an entirely symbolic campaign. Nonetheless, it was very important to get political support from Norway. And it was pressure from this young crowd. And indeed, remember that the current Prime Minister of Norway used to be the head of this AUF group, the Youth League of the Norwegian Labour Party. So on these two fronts, Norway had taken a position far in advance of any other European or North American country vis-a-vis the Palestinian struggle at this time. In other words, support of BDS on the one side and the other support for the statehood campaign in the United Nations. And yesterday, of course, we heard that the United States is not going to support the statehood campaign. It put it out there for discussion, and that is a very significant move the United States has done just after this tragedy in Norway.
Very interesting. We do have a couple of calls. Let's go to the first call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Jeff. Jeff Wright on the Mendocino Coast. You talked about video games and qualifications for Predator pilots. That Mortal Kombat that a lot of people tried to get censored and removed from at least young people playing that, that would be a perfect CIA game for kids to play. And I'm sure if we look at the flip side of that, and if somebody was applying to be a Predator pilot and put on their resume that they did play Mortal Kombat, I seriously doubt it would be a disqualifier.
Good comment.
And as far as the recon right now, I believe they're probably over us at this point, assisting with the marijuana issues in the state of California for recon. I know that they've used them on the borders, our southern U.S. border, and that leads me to believe they'd probably use them on the coasts for the same justification, and probably to assist in recon for assisting the DEA and doing their ops. I'll leave it at that. Thanks for the show, Jeff.
Okay, thanks for your call. So it's already being used. Not surprising. We're coming down to the end of the program. Do you have any last comment, Vijay?
Well, I just want to say that, you know, it's a remarkable thing that we live in a country where the Supreme Court decided that games like Mortal Kombat should not be banned because it would infringe the freedom of speech of young people. You know, it's amazing. You know, since when did the Supreme Court really care about the views of young people? And here we are. We have seen 90 young people in Norway killed, very profound political people. These were not just young people on holiday. These were political actors. This was the future of Norwegian progressive society, and they have been taken from us. So I think let's not just think of this as a human tragedy. I think this is also a political tragedy. Very brave people have been killed.
Well, I want to thank you very much for that, and that's true. And my guest today, Vijay Prashad, you can find works by Vijay. That's VIJAYPRASHAD by Googling his name, your name, and also by going to the Counterpunch website and doing a search, because you have really interesting posts there all the time. So, again, thanks very much for being our guest today and enlightening our listeners.
Thank you so much, and have a nice day.
You too. Take care. Bye-bye.